Thank you very much for the invitation. Please complain if you can't understand my accent. Like Javier, I would like to concentrate on the practicalities. I mean, we can see that there are limitations with the Geneva Conventions. This sort of normative framework, legal framework at a supranational level, really does have limitations. So I'll move on. I won't repeat many of the figures that we've already gone over that show that healthcare itself is under threat. And we'll just try and concentrate on the recommendations. I should point out that this project, the Healthcare in Danger project that the Red Cross has been undertaking for the last 8 years, has now come up with 350 specific recommendations, some of which overlap and in 8 general fields. I won't go through all of these individually for you today, but that they are available in the material that's on the APHA's website, so feel free to tackle that, or indeed the Healthcare in Danger website with ICRC. And I should also point out that whilst I'm here representing ICRC, it is the Red Cross movement with Red Cross organisations, Red Cross, Red Crescent, etc., organisations in each country, literally every country in the world now, and their sort of forum organisation, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, which is in Geneva. And then the third part of this is the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is a private Swiss organisation that is really the guarantor of the Geneva Conventions and is based in Geneva. It tends to work in the areas that the national societies can't. So all of those organisations together came together with our initial blooding, I think, was 1996 when 6 nurses were targeted specifically in Chechnya. Up until then, we'd thought that the Red Cross emblem was a fairly protective item, but that certainly made us realise. So in 2008 to 2010, we did a study that took place in 16 of the countries that we were working in, just to get an idea of whether we could get some sort of statistical analysis of the problems for healthcare implementation. This was interesting enough that we then set up a proper study, this one that is on screen at the moment, January 2012 to December 2015, 4 years. And this was covering 20 countries, but basically some of them were background support countries, and it was only 11 conflict-affected countries that the study was looking at. And it's similar sort of figures to what we've heard from the three previous speakers. I mean, there are an enormous number of incidents, both against healthcare facilities, particularly against local healthcare facilities and locals. So I'll just briefly go over this healthcare in danger process. You can see down at the bottom bit, 2008 to 2011, we were just collecting data to see if a project was really going to be worthwhile. Then we started on a series of expert consultations, and in addition, from 2012 to 2015, we have been working on the attempts to bring other parts of the health community and the international community into the debate. And I'm focusing really in this talk on the implementing recommendations and towards solutions bit, the red bit, with our many, many ways of trying to make something happen rather than just to be yet another topic that's been researched but not much happens from. So each of these here, the top of each page has got the recommendations and then the topic. In this one, it's rights and responsibilities of healthcare personnel. And I won't read out the individual things, but for each of these topics, like rights and responsibilities of healthcare personnel, there is a booklet available. It's a short booklet, easy to download from the web, all on the APHA site references at the moment, so feel free. But each of these goes into the specifics, and we I've put this one first because it's one that's relatively easy to tackle, but it is very clear that we healthcare personnel need to have an idea of international law and medical ethics, and they also need to be able to present that to adversaries when they run into problems. I won't go into that any deeper because I think we're running out of time and it is all available on the web. So we also came out with quite a number of recommendations about ambulances and pre-hospital services in crisis situations. And some of the key points from that I've put down there. Again, it's in a pamphlet, a separate pamphlet if you want it. But it's important that there are coordination mechanisms in place between the service providers and the authorities beforehand. And we also realised that it's very important that communication, alternative forms of communication equipment are available in case the communication systems break down, as they inevitably do in chaos situations. We also recognise that there's the importance of psychological support, including possibly insurance for staff working in situations like this. It's unreasonable for employers to expect that the staff will not be affected deeply by the experiences. And we've also made some recommendations about the use of PPE, personal protective equipment, because it is important to actually judge the appropriate times to use that rather than to automatically leap in with personal protective equipment whilst perhaps other staff don't have or patients are intimidated by it. They're just simple examples of why it does actually need some consideration. And finally, down the bottom, I've put the comment that about the follow-up attack dilemma that Zahur was commenting of, where if there's an attack on a place, and then some adversaries will actually deliberately attack soon afterwards to also involve the healthcare personnel that have been there rescuing people. So another recommendation batch, this is on the safety of healthcare facilities. I think already Javier has very clearly essayed some of the points of that, talking, for example, about building in a weapons-free policy for the hospital or wherever you're working and trying to ensure that that is actually architecturally part of the building and sensibly works without needing too much extra pressure. Won't go into that in any more detail at the moment. I don't think we need to cover the recommendations for our national societies that are implementing here, but I would just highlight the second point down, implementing the safer access framework. We've actually had committees discuss at length what might be sensible precautions to train all National Society, Red Cross National Society staff for how you deal with conflict situations, and that is now built into their prior training. I mean, it's the health equivalent of, for example, if you're going to attend an accident, making sure you look around and see that there's no other traffic on the road bearing down on you and the electricity lines are turned off before you try and prise people away from an electrical accident. So the next batch of recommendations actually came out of a meeting that was in Sydney in 2013, where members of the military from, I think, 30 countries attended and considered how military forces might actually be able to deal better with respecting healthcare if they either agreed the conditions or alternatively they could persuade governments to put them into law. And this is probably the most, for me it's the most fascinating of the booklets because it's largely a result of the military people getting together and coming up with their own suggestions how they could be encouraged to respect medical ethics and medical structures. And a number of governments, Scandinavian governments, several European governments, the Canadian government, and the Australian government is discussing it. have actually tried to bring this into their military codes of conduct, which if they do will make an enormous difference in theory to the safety of the medical facilities. So you can see the things that are covered in that are the ground evacuation and conditions for that, the search operations in healthcare facilities, which sometimes are necessary, and one has to accept that, but they should be accepting the priority of healthcare, urgent healthcare, whilst this is a competition. And the third point was the fighting in proximity of medical infrastructure. This should actually be, obviously, from our point of view, should be minimised, but even the military could see the point of minimising the risk and potential dangers to the medical facilities and the vehicles and the workers. So probably the one that you expect the Red Cross and particularly the ICRC to be putting the most effort into, as one thing that we're probably somewhat better placed to do than many of the other organisations, is to push on domestic normative frameworks for the protection and provision of health. Normative frameworks just means laws, basically, but I'm afraid ICRC has quite high-flown rhetoric on many occasions. And for this, there has actually been quite a lot of work, including the fourth pillar of the Red Cross system that I didn't talk about before, is that there is an international conference every 4 years which includes all of the governments that have signed the Geneva Conventions. And that is taking place this year. And for that convention, there is... I'm rather hoping I can go backwards in a moment. But there are a number of recommendations that have been put up to this international conference this year that we're hoping governments will support and take home. And then the final one that I just briefly mentioned, since time's up, is that we've also been having consultations with the non-state armed groups. I can't tell you which ones, but it's 96 interlocutors from 34 different groups in 9 contexts. 3 contexts were urban, so you can guess that they're probably South America. But the others are actually quite interesting. And again, with them, we've been trying to come out with some recommendations, and that also will be published as a booklet in the coming year. That's one of them that's not out yet. So thank you very much. I apologise, it was a bit of a romp through.